We have our two bills of the week, 550 and 819, up today for continuation on in work session. We have more testimony on these. I think committee my intent will be not to move these today, but to probably carry these over to Monday of next week and try and get them out of our way. Then we also have 3130 today. I think I sent you the memo on to for the purpose of referring the bill without recommendation to the Committee on Rules and Public Affairs. Why don't we save that to the end since we have folks here to signed up to testify, including Senator Charles Starr. So let me open the work session on both 819 and 550. We'll do that together again so everyone is free to talk about whichever. And we'll welcome Charles Starr to join us. Good morning.
Good morning.
We're not going to move into Hayes.
Good morning, Chair Shetterly and representatives. I'm here in support of the Dash A7 amendments to Senate Bill 819. You had, I believe, excellent testimony on those amendments from the district, from Representative Crummell previously. I happened to be out of the building and wasn't here to testify, and I wanted opportunity to share with you my concerns that Sherwood has been drastically under compression for 10 years as they have doubled in population. They have none of the factors that allow extra waiting for students. They, in fact, are well, they are the fastest growing and the lowest funded per pupil district in the state. And the Dash 7s would help to alleviate that and address what I think is a fairness and an equity issue that really needs addressing. They have been able, with superior administration and dedicated teachers, essentially new and young teachers, to maintain a program that requires 6 credits more than the state requirement for graduation. They've been able to maintain that program. That's in danger of going away because of the compression and the funding crisis that we're in today. And I think I would urge you to support the Dash A7 amendments to Senate Bill 819 as a way of adjusting their funding to provide fairness and equity for the Sherwood District. I'm glad to answer any question, Mr. Chair.
Okay. Are there any questions for Senator Starr? I missed the testimony on these yesterday. Representative Verger.
Welcome, Senator Starr. I guess that I have a couple of questions. One is, when you give to one, you take away from someone else, and that concerns me wearing a state hat. The other is that in my district, we have seriously declining schools. North Bend will lose 112 students this year. That puts them in a terrible situation as far as funding is concerned. And I'm very sympathetic with the high-growth schools. I'm a little envious. They've taken away a lot of our young people with their children, and so we miss that in my community. But I'm wondering if it isn't fair that we look at all the situations in Oregon at one time rather than trying to more or less piecemeal satisfy critical conditions in one area such as Sherwood.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, Representative Berger. That is an important issue, and there are critical factors that are not presently adequately addressed in the formula, I believe. And as we look at how we fund our schools, we're going to have to consider those factors. And certainly schools that are declining enrollment are under very serious operation conditions that makes it difficult for them. So I don't disagree with you, but I do strongly urge you to consider this one as we consider the other issues that face schools across our state.
Thank you.
Anything else for the senator?
All right. Thank you for coming in this morning.
Thank you very much.
Next, we have Paula Radich and Jim Marquis. I have a sign-up on 819, nothing on 550. Does anyone want to speak on 550? Oh, come on forward. That's okay. I'm just kind of checking out the crowd while we're changing seats. Okay.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, members of the committee. I'm Jim Marquis, representing the Equity Steering Committee, which is a small group of seven school districts dedicated to the principle that every child in the state ought to get an equal opportunity to be educated. I have with me Dr. Paula Radich, who wants to address Senate Bill 819, and I'm going to let her go ahead, and you can hear from me anytime.
Thanks, Jim. Good morning, Representative Shetterly and committee members. I'm the superintendent of the Newburgh Public Schools. I'm here today, as Jed mentioned, not only representing Newburgh School District, but also the Equity Coalition, a group of member school districts who have fought for and helped achieve equity funding for students in the 1990s. Those districts include Bend Lapine, Woodburn, Silver Falls, Lincoln County, McMinnville, Newburgh, and Central. Our goal today is unchanged. We seek to maintain stable and equal funding for our students and our communities. We believe that the expanded local option provisions outlined in Senate Bill 819 threaten the funding stability and equity we have pledged to maintain. Our districts are rural. For years, we have struggled to provide an education comparable to that offered in many metro districts. Changes in the state funding formula brought welcome relief to our districts and leveled the playing field for our students. The provisions of Senate Bill 819 that expand levy capacity for the local option perpetuate the inequities we have fought so long to overcome. School districts that have successfully passed local option levies quickly outdistance their neighbors in their ability to provide quality education. Because some districts can pass local option levies with ease, we begin to see an increase in the haves and the have-nots in education. Increasing local option capacity has the unintended consequence of creating inequities and creating complacency. How does this happen? Local option levies are not the answer to long-term stable funding for K-12 districts. They are, in fact, detours that disrupt our public from the main message. Our K-12 state-funded schools are bankrupt. If the intent is to return public schools to local control, then so be it. However, by turning that page, we return to the days when the rich get richer and the poor get poorer, something none of us should want for all of our children. Finally, the history of the passage of the local option indicates we are losing ground. In November 1999, the Corvallis School District successfully passed a local option levy with a 65.8% yes vote, the first and only district in 1999 to seek and pass a local option levy. In March of 2000, 3 out of 3 school districts successfully passed local option levies, Helix, Pendleton, and Seaside. In May of that same year, 13 districts placed local option levies on the ballot. 7 levies passed and 6 failed. 5 of the 7 districts passing local option levies in May of 2000 were large metro districts, Eugene, Lake Oswego, Portland, Tigard-Tualatin, and Westland-Wilsonville. In November of 2000, 17 school districts sought local option levies. 3 districts passed and 14 failed. The districts that failed were primarily small rural districts. In 2001, only 4 school districts attempted local option levies, and only 1 of the 4 passed. In 2002, 11 districts attempted local option levies, and 2 passed. To date, the passage rate for local option levies is approximately 33%, 1 in 3. However, that statistic is misleading. The real story is that we have lost ground since 1999. The number of local option levies passing has consistently spiraled downward. Is the local option levy and the expansion of our capability to levy additional funds the answer for K-12 education? I suggest it is not the answer. Local option levies create the false impression that we are doing all right, that we are good stewards of our children's education, and that is not the case. Thank you.
Questions for Dr. Radich? Dr. Radich, I guess I might take a little bit issue with your last statement. I don't think anyone in Portland feels like they've satisfied their school funding problem.
I would concur with that. However, Portland does have capacity to raise funds that rural districts do not.
Even apart from what we're talking about at 8-9.
Correct.
Questions for Ms. Radich?
Mr. Chair, thank you. Can you give us a sense of how things are moving during the same period of time that you're talking about in terms of the formula funding in your district?
The formula funding, provided it remains stable as we've had it for the last two or three years, has been good for our district, and it has been good, I think, overall for the equity districts. Obviously, the revenue shortfall has complicated the issue, but the formula overall, I believe, is a fair formula.
Right, and if I may, that really isn't the question I'm asking. I'm actually asking for the dollars that you've been receiving. I understand that you like the formula, but are the dollars adequate under the formula?
When there's revenue to support that, yes. Currently, no.
Thank you.
Another question? Oh, come on, this is good testimony. One thing I guess, and I'll just broach generally on this concept of local option for either Dr. Radich or for Mr. Marquis. You know, it seems to me it's one thing if my neighbors buy a better model Ford Taurus than mine, if they do it by taking the money out of my bank account to be able to do that. That's one thing. It seems to me, and I should be able to stop them because that's not fair or appropriate or legal. It's another thing if a family member dies and leaves an inheritance, or they receive a gift from somebody and they use that to go out and buy their better model Ford Taurus. It hasn't harmed me. They get a better model Taurus, but I'm no worse off on account of that. Why should I be able to stop them, I guess, from going out and getting that if it hasn't harmed me? That seems to me to be the issue here on local option. My concern is that we talk about equity and equal funding, but really what we're talking about is lowest common denominator and putting everybody in that boat, even though they may have community support, community interest, community willingness and ability to improve their local situation. Why should we at the state level say you can't do that when in order for them to do that, they're not harming any other districts affirmatively?
Mr. Chair, let me take that. I don't think that we're saying that. And I think when the original local option concept came in, we weren't in opposition of that. And an integral part of that, we felt, was a piece that was passed in conjunction with the 10% local option that gave equity grants to districts that would have a more difficult time passing local options to try to level the playing field so that there would be money available from the state to match those districts that had a harder time raising money, because the only way a school district can raise money for a local option is through property taxes, and some districts are more property wealthy than others. I mean, that's just a fact of life. But I think the issue is that we look at local option and say, under your scenario, that doesn't hurt my neighbor if I raise a little extra. But that assumes, I believe, that we're funding all schools adequately to provide a basic education for all kids in some equalized way, some way that brings some semblance of equity, and that then we say if some district wants to do a little extra for their kids, they can do that. We're not there. And we are not at, at a place where we're funding schools adequately to provide a basic education. And every school district has their own story and their own set of problems. And you heard Sherwood's yesterday, and it's a problem for them. And I don't disagree with that. But your job as policymakers is to compare that problem to a problem like is faced in Lincoln County or in Coos County. In Lincoln County, that district has lost 100 to 300 kids every year for the last 7 years, 100 kids spread across 22 buildings. They lose $500,000. They lose three or four kids in one building. And where do you cut overhead to provide a reduction to for a loss of three kids? You don't. And so there are districts that face problems just in providing that basic education. And I guess our concern is that when you provide these kinds of programs for districts that do have the ability to raise the money, you take away the incentive of this body to provide that adequate funding for the basic education for all kids, because I just don't think we're there.
See, and I don't see that having been eroded, that sense of commitment or need to do that. But let me end the conversation here. Representative Williams.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Dr. Radich, Mr. Marquis, it would be unfair if I didn't ask you a question that I asked some other folks the other day after the committee meeting had ended. I heard you say, and I agree with you, that the kinds of things we're talking about here with respect to local options aren't the long-term solution to an adequate and stable school funding approach. What I keep not hearing from people is what is, you know, what's your idea to get us there? And I guess I'd ask both of you that. I've got a bill that I submitted to this committee, House Bill 3500, that's sitting in this committee that would get us to a stable source of long-term funding for education. I haven't heard a whole lot of people clamoring on that bandwagon. So my question to you is, if not these local option short-term fixes to try to help people move this thing forward in small pieces, what's your big fix idea?
I would suggest that there have been numerous discussions relative to issues like a consumption tax or sales tax. Without a new revenue stream, I don't foresee that moving the chairs on the Titanic are going to be any great asset to our long-term solution. And I have a feeling that we are moving those deck chairs fairly rapidly and year after year. I think it's going to take some time to build capacity to support new revenues. I think local districts, while many are impatient because they're facing significant difficulties with the current situation, I think would gather and support some leadership from the legislature relative to some funding. I don't know the complete answer. I think we need to talk with our communities, obviously, about what they would support. But we're eroding our public school system. We're at the core right now of the classroom. We've cut around the edges every year, and now we're at the core. Everyone is cutting teachers that I know of within the state, and we can't continue that.
Well, I'd encourage you both to read House Bill 3500 and tell me if you'd be willing to sign on.
Thank you.
And, Mr. Chair, Representative Williams, my answer would be a little bit different. The funding for K-12 schools comes from the general fund, and it's now half. And I think that we're at a point where there is no one solution. I believe that some districts are much more judicious with their money than others. I think that the legislature probably has to step up and require more accountability from school districts in some areas, because I think there is a need for that. I believe that the legislature has to step up and look at tax expenditures. I think we're giving away more money than we're collecting now. There are a whole variety of things that I think we have to do first, and then I think we can go because I think after we do all that, we still need additional revenue. But I think that's a step we have to go through to allow ourselves to give ourselves the support of the voters, I believe.
Let me
pick up erosion and advance? I think you had a comment.
Yeah, I was just going to ask, thank you, the superintendent, what she would do if you were superintendent of Portland schools. We had that superintendent say, look, you know, we came forward with ballot measure 28, albeit it was a temporary solution. It was, though, a statewide solution. And the majority of voters at Multnomah County and in Polk County and some other places voted yes for that. But statewide, that failed. And voters in Portland would have had a net loss in their tax dollars to help other rural schools, and they were willing to do that. But it failed. And so what they're saying to us is, we got to do the next step. We supported this. The rest of the state didn't. So our step is this local option, and the same holds true in Beaverton. They're doing that. So I just wondered what you would do if you were superintendent of Portland, given the fact that you first went toward a statewide solution and it didn't go anywhere, and you're sort of now left to guard your own flanks and save schools the best way you can.
Yes, Mr. Chair, Representative Haas, I don't have an objection, frankly, to Portland seeking a local option. My concern is the local option is not a long-term solution. I think we need to get out of relying on the local option to salvage our school districts. And my worry is that as long as districts can seek local options and we increase the capacity to do so, the public will not perceive that there is a funding problem. There are a number of districts in my area, very small rural districts, who cannot and probably never will be able to pass a local option. They're hurting by all proportion, the same as Portland, or worse. And I think what we have to remember is that there are rural districts out there who are in very, very difficult financial straits who do not have the ability to pass a local option. Their communities cannot afford to do that.
Representative Hobson.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. A comment first. I would suggest, with all due respect, that Portland did talk to its community, because I appreciate the fact that we all need to do that, and they did come up with at least would be a solution for them. My question is to Mr. Marquis. I appreciated your comments on how we need to get to a minimum level, and then if people want to buy a little bit more, let them go ahead and do that. And I would ask you to explain to me what's the difference. We're certainly not at a minimum level. We're in the pits right now, and we have a district that's trying to find a way to climb just an inch out of that pit to give a little bit more to their students as a temporary stopgap measure that I don't think anybody who really is looking at the big picture could consider a long-term solution. What's the difference between those two additions, whether it's a little bit above a minimum standard or whether it's a little bit above the pit in which we find ourselves?
Chair, Representative Hobson, I believe the difference is that it removes the incentive from this body to provide that basic amount. And every little thing that we do here moves us further away from this concept that every child ought to have this equal opportunity. And I really, I mean, you know, I'm a professional lobbyist and I represent a lot of clients, but this is a concept I believe. And I think this moves us away from that. And I think if we say, okay, well, we're going to provide this equal opportunity, but by the way, if you can find a way in your own district to take care of yourselves, we're gonna be just fine with that. And I mean, this Multnomah County thing, May 20th, you know, it sends a lot of money to Multnomah County school districts, and I think that takes a lot of pressure off in this building to provide adequacy statewide. Now, I don't fault them for that. I don't fault them for trying to take care of themselves because the ship's sinking, and at some point you save yourself. I don't fault them for that. I'm just saying, from a public policy standpoint, for you folks, it removes the incentive.
Yeah, I just disagree with that premise, that $500 or $750 removes the incentive to address.
Well, I can tell you, Mr. Chairman, I can tell you that every time I've been in a committee, when we've looked at funding formula issues, since I started in, and I haven't been around, you know, like Ozzy has for 100 years, but in, since 1991, when we're looking at how to divvy up the money, people want Steve and his folks to give them a computer run so they can go to the line that has their school district on it. And they're looking to see how much money their school district gets. They're not looking to see the adequacy of this on a statewide basis. And so I say to you, when a legislator's school district is taken care of, they're going to be less interested by the very nature of the beast in the statewide problem.
Thank you, Mr. Representative Barnhart.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. We seem to be devolving into a general discussion.
That's okay. We got.
If you don't want that, I'll.
No. This isn't a general discussion. This is all focused on local options.
Well, it is. It is.
Because I say it is.
Yeah.
And you are the chairman.
Well, and of course you're right, because this issue about the local option and the issue of general funding are inextricably linked to each other. You can't deal with one without talking about the other. I think there's several issues that are difficult for us to grasp. One of them, I think the superintendent alluded to in response to one of my questions, and that was this belief that funding is okay, I think is the word she used, when the revenue is good. And from my point of view, from the school districts that I have in my district, funding, even when revenue has been okay, has not been good. Ever since equalization began, funding in Eugene has been in decline and continues to be in decline. So I think we have a different understanding of what an adequate education is, which I think is a very important difference between districts that formerly were well-funded districts and districts that have always been struggling or have had inadequate funding to start with. And so that is a difference statewide between some places and others. On the other hand, I know that there are people who are very interested in education in the rural parts of my district who get angry when I talk about cuts in Eugene because they never had it so good, and they would like to have it so good that as Eugene had in 1990. So that's one of the issues. I would love it if Mr. Marquis's comment were true, and I would vote no on this bill instantly if I thought it were. I believe my experience in this body is that the denial is gigantic and is very difficult to cut through, and that the fact is that many legislators here simply don't want to address the reality that, or they feel helpless about addressing the reality that our educational program is in deep, dire trouble. And I do appreciate your use of the word bankrupt, because I think that accurately describes where we are as a state in terms of dealing with education. And very soon, we'll not only be in the pit, we'll be well below the pit as things are going now. And this legislature hasn't, as far as I can tell, shown any signs of addressing the fundamental issue.
Okay, now you are wandering.
Yeah. But, okay, now I'll get back to the point. In Eugene, we've had a love-hate relationship with this idea of a local option. The Eugene School Board opposed the original bill when I was a member of it, even though it would have potentially made money out of it, and in fact did, because after opposing the bill, we used it to pass a local option. And the reason for that was precisely the same reason that these witnesses were talking about. I don't know where we ought to go on this. I'm inclined to favor the original bill but oppose all the potential amendments, simply because if somebody can be dragged into the lifeboat as the Titanic sinks, that's an improvement of one. But I'd much rather that we funded the system adequately and didn't need these stopgap measures.
Anything else?
Chair.
Representative Hess.
Just to put an exclamation point on that, in real life, we had a town hall the other night at Beaverton High School, had about 150 people, and there is a local option election May 20th in Beaverton, and the people there are furious. They're furious at me, they're furious at Peter Courtney, who joined me at that, because the legislature hasn't addressed that. and they don't believe that this their fear is that they have to do this local option. And if it passes, and I'm optimistic it will in no way, shape, or form put those schools to where anybody will be happy. All that local option is something that will prevent some very, very drastic cuts. And they are still looking to the state to come up with some sort of a tax restructuring that is fair to taxpayers and schools. And so my point is, I guess, to counter your point, that if they pass that local option, they won't say, okay, fine, you guys don't need to do anything. They're very upset that they have to do this, A, and two, if it passes, that's not going to save them.
Mr. Chair, Representative Paz, thank you. I haven't been in your district, and I perhaps shouldn't make assumptions about what your district feels or doesn't feel. I do want to say that an integral part of this local option process, and I want to emphasize this again, has been these equity grants, so that property poor districts have a little better shot at passing them. There are, I guess, some districts that might be affected by this if you move it forward. I would encourage you to make sure that the appropriations are adequately made, and if it is required, even tie those appropriations to this bill, which I think would personally be a good idea. So thank you very much.
Representative Humpson, I think you had a...
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I just had a comment, and I certainly agree with Mr. Markey, and I'm guilty, as I think we all are. We get the runs, and you zero in. I mean, I hit Clatsop County, and then I hit Tillamook County. That's very true. On the other hand, I think those of us who are elected to be here, that is exactly why we're here, to look at the big picture. And I think an awful lot of people do indeed do that. I happen to represent districts that Dr. Radich was referring to, that for most cases we wouldn't even put any local options up because it would be a waste of time, energy, and money to try and do it. On the other hand, I've reluctantly, or at least been drugged into agreeing and using your analogy, the fact that we need to allow a little bit of room for some of these people to get a teeny bit more. And I certainly agree with Representative Williams. It's nobody in their right mind is going to think this is solving the problem.
Okay. Anything else? Representative Barnard.
Mr. Chair, I said a minute ago that I would probably not support any amendments to 819. In fact, I would support one that we don't have. And that's an amendment that ties the passage of 819 to the funding that Mr. Markey referred to. So that 819 goes into effect only if we get the funding.
Enough of that. I want to understand. So what I've gathered from your testimony is that you would support a local option if once we attain adequate funding statewide, and somebody be sure and send a telegram when we hit that point, and two, when the smallest, most rural district in the state would pass one, I guess. So because we shouldn't do it because we don't have adequate funding, and we shouldn't do it because there are small rural districts that can't pass one. That's what I heard. So if you turn those around, then that's when we should do it. And I guess at that point, we wouldn't need it.
Representative Shetterly,
yeah.
We have a local option, and we didn't oppose it when it came into being. We're not opposing local options generally. We're opposing this particular bill that expands the local option from 10% to 15%. And I assure you, if you pass this bill next session or the session after, someone will have a bill to take it to 20%.
We're not voting on that one, but okay. Anything else? Okay. Well, appreciate you coming down.
Thank
for
you
our
much.
Conversation this morning. Ozzie Rose, you wanted to come up? I don't want anyone to mistake this. This is what passes for fun in the Revenue Committee.
Fun? Mr. Chair, members of the committee, for the record, I'm Ozzie Rose with the Confederation of Oregon School Administrators. And opening comments in the last testimony identified the districts as those concerned about equity for all kids, and I submit to you that there are more than seven districts concerned about that. This issue really boils down to two things. the argument that if you do this, you're going to get in the way of the big fix. Or two, that it upsets the concept of equity. What this bill, the proposal does, is change the $500 to $750 and the 10% to 15% on the cap. Those numbers we developed the last time we did this. There's nothing magic that that's the right number. And there's nothing magic that the change here will totally upset equity. I don't think it will. I don't think it gets in the way of the big fix. The argument, if we argue that if anybody does anything, we're never going to get a big fix, then you're not going to get a big fix in my lifetime. The big fix issue is an issue of public opinion. And my testimony before some of your other committees, my challenge to my disappointment in the legislators and challenge to them isn't that you're struggling or that you can't do some things. It's that you need to help take the leadership to help public opinion change about how we do business in Oregon, if you think we should. If you don't think we should, obviously. But you put out Measure 28, and then a third of you signed a voter's manifesto saying we didn't need to do it. It's pretty hard for the public to get that stuff straightened out. And so that's the issue. We have to have a discussion with the public in which public opinion changes. They've had a decade of political campaigns by candidates from both sides of the aisle that said when they ran, runs from March to November of every even-numbered year for the last decade, a very expensive PR campaign with little nuances depending on the makeup of the district, but essentially said, we're going to have really good schools, we're going to have good public safety, we're going to lock up people, we're going to have health care, we can give back the kicker, and we won't need to raise taxes. Now, there's nuance on that, but by and large, that's the public information campaign that's been run for a decade. And why wouldn't the public believe that? Of course they do. It doesn't quite work out. We don't quite have the resources to do the things we want. And it's across the board, and you know all that. But we've got some work to do before we get the answer to the big fix. This doesn't get in the way of that. If you believe this little thing gets in the way of that, then you're going to have to buy into that we're never going to get anything done. More specifically, the argument that only the big districts would be able to do this. The OT03 local options. Here are the districts that currently have local options. Corvallis, West Lynn, Lake Oswego, Eugene, Portland, Riverdale, and Tigard. Relatively large metro area. Colton, Seaside, Sisters, Oakland, Crow Applegate, Helix, and Pendleton. Equal number of rural districts and metro districts are currently using a local option. And, by the way, this is also very difficult. The previous testimony identified the seven districts. Three of those seven districts sat on the group that gives me directions. These are difficult questions for people. But the argument that this gets in the way of the big fix, I don't think washes. I think that people need to, till we get the big fix, have some flexibility to try to keep things going. I don't know if you've read the letter from Mr. Rodriguez. I think it was sent to all of you this week. It's a copy of a article he sent to the Hillsborough Argus.
Oh, yeah.
And he goes over the staffing, the students, and the buildings at Hillsborough and the change in 23 years, from 82 to 83. And this is illustrative of what's going on in every school. The numbers are different. In 1982, they had six buildings and 20 administrators in their secondary schools. Now they have 10 buildings and 20 administrators. If they staffed their classes the same way they staffed them 20 years ago, they'd have 133 more teachers in the Hillsborough School District. Pendleton's laying off. I mean, you know all of that stuff. That's a problem. I don't think that the change being asked for here fixes that problem. I also don't think it stops us from fixing that problem. It does let some districts try to take this to their people and see if they can mitigate that problem until we get the big fix. Please answer any questions.
Questions for Mr. Rose? Okay. Thank you.
All right. It's an energizing way to start the day. Anybody else want to come into the pit? Okay, I guess not. Committee will have these back on the schedule and work for work session on Monday, and we'll make a decision one way or another. And I'll be talking to you in the meantime, as I'm sure others will. With that, I'll close the work session on Senate Bill 819 and Senate Bill 550. And I'll open a work session on 3130. Again, committee, this is the one where we have been requested to send this to the Rules Committee for the relating clause, not for the bill.
Oh. Mr. Chair?
Representative Williams.
Do you know anything about the intent of this bill when it gets to the Rules Committee?
I do not have any authoritative knowledge of the intent of the Rules Committee. It might have something to do with... I don't want to guess. But not this. Yeah. What? No, 31. 3130, you've got 3031.
Oh, I do that every once in a while.
This relating clause is not video lottery game retailers, for the record. Just trying to throw something else into the mix, huh?
Yeah, number's a number.
With that, committee, the chair would move House Bill 3130 be referred without recommendation to the Committee on Rules and Public Affairs. Representative Barnhart?
Well, the point of this is not to deal with the issue that's in the bill.
That is correct.
And therefore it won't have or it's unlikely to have the kind of revenue issue that really is within our purview.
That is correct.
Okay. Well, on that basis, I'll vote for the motion.
Okay. Any discussion? Please call the roll.
Representative
Barnhart?
Aye.
Berger?
Aye.
Barr?
Aye.
Pass?
No.
Hobson?
Aye.
Pass?
You're contrarian,
aye.
Berger?
Aye.
Williams?
No.
Kirshner?
Aye. House Bill 3130 goes to the Committee on Rules and Public Affairs without recommendation and shrouded in mystery. With that, we'll close the work session on House Bill 3130, and committee, we are adjourned. It has...